Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. I mentioned last week that in this canto, Sri Aurobindo is sharing with us the secret knowledge that King Aswapati has gained as a result of the action of the goddess, the illumining, revealing action of the goddess of inspiration, which we read about in the previous canto. Last week, we read the whole of the first section, I think. We read and looked at the whole of the first section. Am I right? Yes? And that ends with these beautiful lines, which we just heard Mother reading. So this first section is an assurance to us that even when we fail to look into our souls, and even when we lie embedded in earthly consciousness, still have we parts that grow towards the light. And we can have experiences when we look within. When we are concentrated within, we can have wonderful experiences that are signals, signs of a greater self which is living within us by ourselves, unseen. The second section begins with the word but. It gives the other side of the picture, and we should read this second section before we look at each sentence in detail. Would you start, Sudhanya?
But all is craving subliminal mystical. It needs the intuitive heart, the inward tongue. It needs the ball of a spiritual gaze. Else, through our working minds, small moment look, a colorless voice seems or dubious course. Some chance has settled or hazard some will or a necessity without aim or cause. Unwillingly compelled to emerge and be. In this dense field where nothing is plain or sure, our very being seems to us questionable, our life a vague experiment, the soul a flickering light. The strains ignores all, they are a mechanic accident, a net of death in which by chance we live. All we have learned appears a doubtful this, the ascending down a passage or a phase, whose further aim is hidden from our sight. The chance happening or a fortuitous fate. Out of the unknown, we move to the unknown, ever surrounded or brief existence here, grey shadows of unanswered questioning, the dark inconscience, signless mysteries, stand up unsolved behind the fate's curtain line, an aspiration in the night's profound, seed of perishing body and half-lit mind. Uplifts its lonely tongue of conscious fire towards an undying light forever lost. Only it hears soul echo of its call, the dim reply in man's unknown heart, and makes not understanding why it came or for what reason is the suffering here. God's sanction to the paradox of life and the riddle of the immortal's birth in time.
Thank you. Poonam.
Along a path of eons serpent time, in the coiled blackness of her nestling crows, the earth's goddess toils across the sands of time. A being is in her whom she hopes to know, a world speaks. her heart, she cannot hear. A fate compels whose form she cannot see. In her unconscious orbit through the void, out of her mindless depths, she strives to rise. A perilous life her game. A struggling job, a thought that can conceive but hardly knows arises slowly in her and creates the idea, the speech that labels more than it likes, a trembling gladness that is less than bliss, invades from all this beauty that must die, alarmed by the sorrow dragging at her feet and conscious of the high things not yet won. Ever she nurses in her sleepless breast an inward urge that takes from her rest and peace, ignorant and wary and invincible, she seeks through the soul's war and quivering pain the pure perfection her marred nature needs. A breath of Godhead on her stone and mire. A faith she craves that can survive defeat, the sweetness of a love that knows not death, the radiance of a truth forever sure.
Thank you. Ravi.
A light grows in her, she assumes a voice. Her state she learns to read, and act she has done. But the one needed truth eludes her grasp, herself, and all of which sees the sign, and inarticulate whisper drives or stays, of which she feels the force but not the sense. A few rare intimations, a few rare intimations come as guides, immense dividing flashes crave her brain, and sometimes in her hours of dream and muse, the truth that she has missed looks out on her as if far off and edge within her soul. A change comes near that flees from her surmise, and ever postponed compels attempt and hope. It seems too great for mortal hope to dare. A vision meets her of supernal powers that draw her as if mighty kinsmen lost, approaching with estranged great luminous gaze. Then is she moved to all that she is not, and stretches arm to what was never heard, outstretching arms to the unconscious void. Passionate she prays to invisible forms of gods, soliciting from dumb fate and toiling time what most she needs, what most exceeds her scope. A mind unvisited by illusion's gleam, a will expressive of soul's deity, a strength not forced to stumble by its speed, a joy that drives not sorrow as its shape.
Thank you. We'll pause there. Praveen?
For these she hears and feels them the esteem hers. Heaven's privilege she claims as her own. Just is her claim, the all-witnessing God's approval, clear in a greater light than reason owns. Our bring chimeras are two schemes in hell, the impossible gods sign things to do. But few can look beyond the present state, or overleap this magic head of sense. All that transpires on earth and all beyond are parts of an illimitable plan. The one keeps in his heart and knows alone. Our outward happenings have their seed within. And even this random fate that imitates chance, this mass of unintelligible results, are the dumb graph of truths that work unseen. The laws of the unknown create the unknown. The events that shape the appearance of our lives are a cipher of subliminal quiverings, which rarely we surprise or vaguely feel, are an outcome of suppressed reality. Hardly rise into material labor. They are born from the spirit's sun of hidden powers, digging eternal through emergency.
Thank you. Will you read?
But who shall pierce into the cryptic dust and learn what deep necessity of the soul? Determine casual deed and consequence. Absorbed in a routine of daily acts, our eyes are fixed on an ephemeral sphere. We heard the crash of the wheels of circumstance and wonder at the hidden cause of things. Yet a foreseeing knowledge might be ours if we could take our spirit's stand within, if we could hear the muffled demon voice. Who seldom is the shadow of what must come, cast in an instant from the secret sense, which feels the shock of being visible. And seldom in the few who answer the mighty process of the cosmic will, communicates his image to our sight, identifying the world's mind with ours. Our range is fixed within the crowded arc of what we observe and touch and thought can guess, and where we dawns the light of the unknown, waking in us the prophet and the seer. The outward and the immediate are our field. The dead past is our background and support. Mind keeps the soul prisoner. We are slaves to our acts. We cannot free our gaze to reach wisdom's sun.
Thank you. Andres.
Inheritor of the brief animal mind, man is still a child in nature's mighty hands. In the succession of the moments lives, his memory stares back at the phantom past. The future flees before him as he moves. He sees imagined garments, not the first. Armed with limited precarious strength, he saves his fruits of work from adverse chance. A struggling ignorance is his wisdom's mate. He waits to see the consequence of his acts. He waits to weigh the certitude of his thoughts. He knows not what he shall achieve or when. He knows not whether at last he shall survive or end like the mastodon and his love, and perish from the earth where he was king. He is ignorant of the meaning of his life. He is ignorant of his high and splendid fate. Only the immortals under deathless heights, dwelling beyond the walls of time and space, masters of living free from the bonds of thought, were overseers of fate and chance and will, and experts of the theorem of world need, can see the idea, the might that change time's course, come made with light from undiscovered worlds. Here, while the world toils on with its deep, blind heart, the galloping hooves of the unforeseen event, bearing the superhuman rider near and impassive to earth's dim and stubborn quiet, return to the silence of the hills of God. As lightning leaps, as thunder sweeps, they pass and leave their mark on the trampled breast of life.
Thank you. Marlon.
Above the world, the world creator's strength, in the phenomena sees its mystic source. These aid heed not the deceiving outward world. They return not to the moment's busy. But listen with the still patience of unbound. the slow footsteps of our destiny, approaching through huge distances of time, unmarked by the time that sees that it comes, unheard with the glamour of the human pain, attempting to an unseen foot disease, sound as of invisible poker wheels, voicing of an unplumbed significance, matrix that grew in the core of matter sleep, in the heart's potential we can catch the murmurs lost by life's uncaring ear, a prophet's speech in thought's omniscience trance, above the illusion of the hopes that pass, behind the covert act, behind this clockwork chance and vague surmise, amid the rustle of force, the dampening heat, across the cries of anguish and of joy, across the triumph, fighting in despair, they watch the bliss for which Earth's heart has cried, on the long road which cannot see its end, while being undetected through the septic gaze, and to reach its guide, the unheedful moving world.
Thank you. Ram Narayan.
Thus, when the master transcendent mount is thrown, the darkness deepens, strengthening the earth's breast, and man's corporeal mind is the only lamp, as the thieves in the night shall be the covered tread of one who steps unseen into his house. A voice in her shall speak, the soul to be, a power into mind's inner chamber steel, a charm and sweetness open life's closed doors, and beauty conquered the resisting world, that took life captured nature by surprise, a stone of God conquered the heart to bliss, and earth grows unexpectedly beyond. In matter shall be rich the spirit's glow, in body and body kindled to the earth, sacred world, awake to the unconquered star. The days become a stacking within March, our will the force of the eternal power and of the rays of a spiritual sun. If you shall see what man yet understands, God shall grow up while the wise men talk and sleep. Men shall not know the coming till its hour, and believe shall be not till the work is done.
Sri Aurobindo's wonderful assurance to us. These last four lines Mother has referred to, I think, five times in the agenda. They moved her very much, as they move us. So let's go back to the beginning of the section on page 49. Sri Aurobindo's describing our situation here on Earth. Chitra, would you read? Thank you. The first section gave us this inspiring assurance of the greater self that lives within. But that is screened. It's in our subliminal. We are not usually actively conscious of it. It's mystical. To be in contact with it, it needs the intuitive heart, the inward turn, the power of a spiritual gaze. Otherwise, to our waking mind, with its small moment look, which just sees things on the surface as they appear now, it seems as if we may be on a voyage which doesn't really have an aim. There are large sections of educated humanity who believe that it's a serious mistake to imagine that our life here might have an aim or a goal. It seems like a goalless voyage. The course is dubious. We don't know where it should go and where it is leading to. It seems to have been settled by some chance, or perhaps, possibly, some will, or a necessity without aim or cause has unwillingly, unintentionally compelled all this material universe to emerge and be. Our gurus, the scientists, don't even want us to try to imagine where our and from what our universe might have originated. No, they say the Big Bang, that's the singularity. We can't possibly know what was before that. Everything that's in the universe has emerged from that mysterious event. No? Unwillingly. There was no will behind it. And in this dense field, this material world, where nothing is plain or sure, we can't really understand anything or be sure, absolutely sure of anything. Even our own being seems to us questionable. Do we really exist or not? It's a question that can be asked, that philosophers have asked. No? Our life is a vague experiment. We're constantly trying things out without really knowing what we're aiming at. If we have a soul, it's just a little flickering light in this strange world of ignorance. And the earth, the material earth on which we live, seems to have emerged just by accident, without intention, a brute, mechanic accident, as a result of the laws of physics and the laws of physics. It seems to be a net of death in which, by chance, here we are alive for a while. Everything we have learned appears a doubtful guess, a hypothesis. We can't be sure of its truth. No? Whatever achievement has been made by humanity or by nature seems to be something temporary, a passage or a phase, and its further end, where it is going to, is hidden from our sight. A chance happening, it may be just random, or a fortuitous fate, something that's fixed, but fixed only by chance. We don't know where we've come from, and we don't know where we're going. Out of the unknown, we move to the unknown. This is the human condition as it appears to our waking minds. Small moment look. Sri Aurobindo is going to show us much greater perspectives. Lorraine.
Gray shadows, unanswered questionings, the dark, unconscious, signless mysteries, stand up unsolved behind fate's starting line, an aspiration in the night's profound sea of a perishing body and a half-lit mind, uplifts its lonely tongue of conscious fire towards an undying light forever lost. Only it hears soul echo of its call. The dim reply in man's unknowing heart and meets not understanding why it came or for what reason is the suffering here. God's sanction to the bare paradox of life and the riddle of the immortal's birth in time.
Thank you. Anybody has anything they would like to share or to ask about these lines? Will they?
Well, then, stay in the moment.
Yes. Remain in the moment.
Yeah,
yes. Because otherwise we don't know.
Yeah.
Mm. Yes. Well, perhaps staying in the moment is a way of coming in contact with another consciousness. One way, one recommended way. Yes. These first few lines, starting with this line 145, out of the unknown, move to the unknown. And then the next sentence. It reminds me of a story about the beginning of Christianity in Great Britain. What is now Great Britain was divided up into different kingdoms that were ruled by pagan kings, some of them from Scandinavia, others from elsewhere. And there's a story about the Christian teacher, Bede, that he visited the king. He was visiting the king of Northumbria, which is quite a cold, shadowy, grey, windy, cold place. The king had a great hall with a fire in the middle, open windows and doors, and there was a storm raging outside. And a little bird flew in through the door or through one of the windows and moved around in the light and the warmth of the hall. And then it found its way out through the hole above the fire, the chimney. And Bede said to the king, "Look, that is like our soul. It comes in from the dark. It's here for a little while in the light and the warm, and it's gone." But Jesus Christ tells us another story. And he spoke to the king about the basis of Christianity, and the king was converted, and then naturally the whole kingdom was converted, and that was the beginning of Christianity in Great Britain. It's something like that. Sri Aurobindo is giving us this picture. Do you know where you came from? You came in out of the storm, and you'll leave. You don't know where you will go. Just for a time, your life is lighted up. You're not sure whether it has any meaning or not. But he says there is another side to the story. And then there's this mysterious, I find it mysterious, this next sentence. An aspiration in the night's profound, seed of a perishing body and half-lit mind, uplifts its lonely tongue of conscious fire towards an undying light forever lost. Only it hears soul echo of its call, the dim reply in man's unknowing heart, and meets not understanding why it came or for what reason is the suffering here, God's sanction to the paradox of life and the riddle of the immortal's birth in time.
I think that is God's sanction to the paradox of life and the riddle I only was really introduced to it until I came to India. Society seems to have recognized this.
That God has said yes to this.
And lived with it for centuries.
Yes. Perhaps this aspiration in the deepest dark of the night, this is the aspiration perhaps that Sri Aurobindo speaks of in the first chapter of The Life Divine, The Human Aspiration. That's the title of the first introductory chapter of The Life Divine. And he points out that despite all evidence to the contrary and all objections and denials, it's as if there does persist in humanity a conviction that things must surely one day become better. There must be a benign divine power. There must be something like immortality. There must be something like perfect knowledge and perfect realization. And perhaps that is the seed of this that's keeping these bodies going, these half-lit minds. We're carrying something of this aspiration within us. And he says that aspiration is uplifting its lonely tongue of conscious fire, a flame of aspiration, Agni. It's climbing up, reaching up, towards an undying light, which here in this world we feel we have lost that light, that we've fallen, that we've lost touch with that undying light. The aspiration mounts up, and the only response it gets, the only echo of its call, is some kind of response in the human heart. The ignorant human heart nevertheless says yes. And what support and encouragement do we have for that response? It's the conviction somehow that God has said yes, that this is not all meaningless. There is a sanction to this paradox, this contradictory, puzzling, bewildering life that we find ourselves in. There's the mystery that something immortal has taken birth in time, and the human soul is a part of that, the soul of humanity and the soul of each individual being here. But it's all very puzzling. Why would God say yes? Why would he set up this riddle of birth in time? Perhaps we will, well, certainly by the end of the canto, we will have a kind of answer to this question.
So, for me, this is also a paradox.
Sorry?
For me, this is a paradox in time, immortal. So
exactly, this is a paradox. Why and how would immortality take birth in time? And what is immortality after all? Yes.
Then time is useless.
Why time? Why is there a sanction to this paradox?
So beautiful, all this mystery.
Alice, would you read? Alice, are you with us? No. Patricia.
Along the path of aeons serpentine, in the coral blackness of her nescient course, the earth goddess toils across the sands of time. A being is in her whom she hopes to know. A word speaks to her heart she cannot hear. A fate compels whose form she cannot see. In her unconscious orbit, through the void, out of her mindless depth, she strives to rise. A perilous life, her game, a struggle. arises slowly in her and creates the idea, the speech that labels more than it might, a tremor of gladness that is less than bliss invades from all this beauty.
Mm. Thank you. It's a beautiful symbolic picture. No. Somehow, instinctively, we human beings, as far back as we can see, have always thought of the earth as our mother. And in this poem, Shobindo often refers to her as the ancient mother. And in the Indian tradition, earth, the element earth, is the material principle. So it's not only our planet, it refers to the whole material universe. And here he images her, the earth goddess, that our earth is not just a lump of matter, there's a divine being within it. She is following this journey, coiled blackness of her nascent course. In evolution, she follows a kind of spiral course, unconsciously, without knowledge, nascent. And it's like toiling across the desert. If you've ever had to walk a long way across sand dunes, you will know what an effort it is, how hard it is to keep going. No? It's toiling. It's not an easy journey. She has to keep going because of this being within her that she doesn't know, but she wants to know, because there's a kind of command, a word is speaking to her heart. She can't hear what it's saying, but she can hear its urging. And she's compelled by this fate, this determinism of the material universe. She can't see and understand what that is, but she's compelled by it. There she is, this planet embodying all this, supporting all this, whirling in her unconscious orbit through the emptiness of space, but through her creatures, her children, the beings that emerge from her. She's trying to rise out of this unconsciousness of matter. And because of that struggle of hers, she has brought about life, more or less conscious life, embodied in material forms. But it's a perilous life. It doesn't last long. It's always threatened by danger. She's brought a kind of delight into the capacity for delight into matter. But it's a struggling joy forever facing all kinds of contradictions and obstacles. And beyond life, even thought, mind has emerged. It's a mind that can form ideas, doesn't really know, doesn't really have knowledge. But it is rising up slowly in her. It's created ideas. It's created speech, which is our speech, allows us to express ideas. But our speech and the ideas that we have don't really express a deep knowledge about the things. We just label them. Flower, glass, table. We don't really know them. No? And the labels don't give us much light, much guidance about the true nature of the things that we label. There is this struggling joy, this trembling gladness, this gladness that feels threatened, no? It's a gladness, it's a kind of delight, but it's less than bliss, and it feels its own inadequacy, no? But it's coming into her, into us, from all this beauty which must die because it's material.
Can you apply that idea of speech that labels more than it likes? You could equally say that about the words that we use to describe consciousness, the words that we use to describe God, the words that we use to describe all of the abstracts and all the things that we want to attribute the positive, all of these two.
Yes, they are labels. And perhaps we use these labels. They don't really give us much help for knowledge. This mind can hardly know. The way that we come to real knowledge is through experience. And those experiences that were described in the first section, those are experiences that bring a kind of knowledge, kind of light. And then we may want to put labels on them. But the only words that can really give us knowledge are the words of the mantra. If we can pass through the four stages of becoming familiar with a mantra, traditionally there are four stages. First, expressing it aloud, perhaps very loud, but it has to be spoken, and it has to be spoken with a certain pronunciation and rhythm. This is the body of the mantra. And then we have to have some help, perhaps, from the guru to understand the labels, the words, and their connection, the grammatical connection, the sentence, to become familiar with that until some mental understanding wakes up in our mind. Aha, that's what it means. And if we then concentrate deeply on those, that rhythm, sounds, structure, meaning, we may be blessed with the revelation of the truth which is expressed in that mantra. We may get the experience and carry it with us, and that will change the course of our inner growth.
It said that the guru gives an empowerment to the mantra.
Of course, he puts his force behind it, yes, to help us through that process, yes. And it's described here as when the mantra sinks in yoga's ear, as one of Sri Aurobindo's huge long sentences about that in book 4, canto 3, I think. We'll come to it, yes. How the mantra works. Yes, Patricia.
As a poet, maybe I would love to hear your comment. This line, "This beauty that must die," in the preceding lines, he's not really referring to beauty. This is my feeling about it. But with this sudden, and it's so, like what he's describing, and then suddenly, oh yes, he really catches us, because we can really relate to
We can
this.
Relate to this, yes.
Right.
Yes.
What he does, and he's just, the way he keeps us with him.
Yes.
And relates it to our personal.
To our personal experience, yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there any antecedent for this beauty?
I don't know if it has come already, but it will come.
Yes, it comes later.
Yes.
Like
yes.
I have a question to the mantra again. How we know that we spoke the mantra well?
Well, of course, if we have the great privilege of having the guru speak it into our ear, then hopefully we are carrying his we are carrying the memory of that in our subtle being. And we of course, we don't have a recording of Sri Aurobindo's reading of Savitri, or of anything. We don't have a recording of Sri Aurobindo's voice.
I
perhaps I can define it because scientists now can find more and more things.
They can what?
Find more and more things. For example, they analyzed people when they read poems. And they found out during reading a poem that it acts in your happiness.
In a special place.
Yes. And activate joy only by reading a poem.
Yes. So that's what's happening to us, isn't it? We are reading and joy, and not only joy, but light is getting activated. No? That's what's happening.
Full of mantras, and behind is a guru, at least my guru. Yeah. For me, reading that,
yes, some people, when we first started this exercise of studying Savitri, some people said, Savitri isn't meant to be studied. Savitri is mantra. You know, you just have to read it and repeat it. So I was rather encouraged when a very great Vedic scholar visited us, and he told what I've just told you about the four stages. He said, traditionally, in a Gurukul, the first thing was to get the pronunciation right. So I don't know how far we're getting the pronunciation right, but I feel that Sri Aurobindo tells us, no, in the, if we follow the, then he's written about meter and about rhythm, and he said he's not doing any fancy kind of metrical things. He's following the normal rhythms of English speech. And it's published in the Future Poetry. It's an essay on quantitative meter. Yes. Yes, but there are the four stages. So I think it is the fourth stage, you know. You've got the rhythm right. You're repeating it. You've got the primary mental understanding of what of the structure and what this sentence implies. And then you're concentrating on that until the mind falls silent. And into the silent mind, receptive mind, comes the meaning, the power, the influence of the mantra.
But is it also in, does it happen also in reverse way, that means in your silent state?
Something may come to you, yes, for sure, yes. Either into the mind or into the heart. If it comes into the heart, it may be more powerful.
Because nowadays we don't see so many gurus giving mantras.
But we can be so grateful that our gurus are with us. And they can at any moment gift us something. Yes.
Our guru is reading this mantra.
Yes.
Mother is reading.
Yes, we have mother's readings. Yes.
But you want to explain so far the three stages, the fourth stage will come.
Well, it's somehow implied there. First, the pronunciation, the rhythm. Second, the grammar. The third stage is when that makes sense to you. You have a mental recognition of what it means. And then you have to concentrate on that meaning, whatever has come to you with your mind so intensely and with such aspiration and receptivity, that the fourth thing is the revelation of the original truth, which is...
The fourth is the spiritual force of communication.
Yes, yeah.
And what we're doing here is in the second category.
I feel what we are doing when we are together, it is the first two stages. It's trying to get the sound and the rhythm right, and the mental understanding. What do the images imply? What can we get from them? What do the words mean? What are their suggestions? What are the connections, the grammatical connections within the sentences? I think the other steps we have to do quietly ourselves at home. We can't do it here in a group.
And it can come as a light came now.
Yes, exactly. Yes. You repeat it mentally. Which is the revelation.
But your question about the how to pronounce, I think it just has to be according to the dictionary, the English speech, no?
I think perhaps the accent doesn't matter so much. We have all different accents here. I think that's not the important thing. I think the important thing is the music and the rhythm. Yes. Yes, Lyuba.
Because in poetry, classical poetry, the accent word is important. And why did in Saviti, I don't know if the accent word in America.
Well, Shobindo has given us the clue that he was basing it on iambic pentameter.
Hmm? Is it important for a mantic kind of repetition, the accent,
and
all that?
I think a certain rhythm and
intonation, is it important?
The intonation follows your understanding of the meaning, no? But I mean he's done it in a certain way. The basic most commonly used meter in English is iambic pentameter. It means da-da, 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 da-da. That Shakespeare is written in that, or most English, Milton, all that. But it's interesting how to this normal rhythm, which is normal to English speech. If you listen to me, maybe I'm speaking in iambic pentameters. It's the rhythm of English speech. And in that essay which I mentioned, he says how flexible it is. It's not that certain words have fixed values. There are many words, they can be either long or short. No, it's not like rigid like the classical meters. So, although it is all 1 meter, all through these 24,000 lines, it's never monotonous. It never goes da 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 da. It never does. It is absolutely marvelously musical, and he has put so much consciousness into that, the evocative values of the sounds and the rhythm.
Because Mother has read this one and we hear readily.
We can definitely follow Mother. She told people to read aloud, slowly, with as much consciousness as possible. That was the guidance that she gave to Nirod, to Huta, I don't know, to maybe others. And that's what she does.
It's interesting that in the West, this knowledge of the connection between mantra and enlightenment is completely missing almost. The nearest they come to it is Baha music.
Yes.
And even in the Bible it says, in the beginning was the word was God. And this connection between the divine and sound and vibration is only really to be found in India.
Yes. In India, if we think about from here, we think about the creation of the universe, the sudden emergence of they say a big bang, an explosion. But here in India, we say it is Shiva chanting, Om, Om, Om. These are the vibrations which have spread out and created this cosmos.
The culture from America, the continent, they have the same kind of thing with the vibration.
I was living in Patagonia, in Argentina, and I was very surprised. This is a sacred ceremony that no people that they are not invited, they cannot come. It's not for guests. And when they start, they say, I tell you, it's exactly the same oath that we use and we go for the Tibetans. So I was really shaking. And the Mayas also, the sound for the, these cultures are very close to India.
There's a couple of lines of one of Sri Aurobindo's poems. He says, perhaps the heart of God forever sings and worlds come throbbing out with every note. Let's listen to Mother reading.
He is a spirit in an unfinished world that knows him not and cannot know itself. The surface symbol of his goalless quest takes deeper meaning to his inner view. His is a search of darkness for the light of mortal life through immortality. In the vessel of an earthly embodiment, over the narrow rails of limiting sense, he looks up on the magic waves of time, where mind, like a moon, illumines the world's dark. There is limb ever retreating from the eye, as if in a tedious, misty, dreamlike dawn, the outline of a dim, mysterious shore. A sailor on the inconscient, fathomless sea, he voyages through a starry world of thought, on matter's deck to spiritual sun, across the noise and multitudinous sky, across the rapt and knowable silence, through a flaming world under supernal sight, beyond longitude and latitude. His goal is fixed outside all present.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.